awake. Shake dreams from your hair, my pretty child, my sweet one. Choose the day and choose the sign of your day, the day's divinity. First thing you see. A vast, radiant beach and a cool, jeweled moon. Couples naked race down by its quiet side. And we laugh like soft, mad children, smug in the woolly cotton brains of infancy.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Throwback Friday.
Throwback Friday. Throwback Friday. Throwback Friday. Throwback Friday.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and this is Throwback Friday.
Throwback Friday.
Throwback Friday.
So today, in honor of October, which is just around the corner, we have a very spooky episode to get you in the pre-Halloween mood. The first is a minisode called Ghost Story, which was released about 2 years ago in October 2013. And maybe I'm a little biased, but it is one of my personal favorites. Following that, we have an episode about Bigfoot that was released in March 2014. It's gonna be so spooky and entertaining, and you'll never believe the story that Randy heard on his mission. Trust me, you won't want to miss it. And if you listen to the very end, you'll hear some trivia about an LDS hymn that you probably didn't know and probably don't even care about. And now, because I edited this episode before I put the introduction on, and I've got to stall a little bit to get to where the actual episode starts, and or else I have to redo everything, and I'm not going to do that. So without any further ado, I give you today's episode.
How about Ghost Story, man?
That was great. That was like that one was of the early episodes. I loved telling that story and putting it together. I had the AC/DC music at the beginning, and I spent so much time like trying to get that at the right level.
Oh, that
levels.
Was a good one. And you had that scene from what's that movie that
for your life? Hold on for your life.
Oh yeah, yeah, that clip in there with Rip Torn. Yeah, I forgot.
Yeah.
Was that in that one?
Yeah, I guess pretty sure.
Yeah, I don't remember.
It was a normal night, just like any other night. I was 16 years old, a priest in the Aaronic priesthood. In a few short years, I would become a missionary, venturing out to the front lines, a valiant soldier in the great cosmic war against Satan and his demon hordes. My bedroom was in the basement. I slept in a twin bed that faced a large, sunken window well. It was meant to be a fire escape, but I often used it to sneak out at night to go teepeeing with my friends. At least until I saw the Black Widow spider webs and decided it was just too risky. Because, you know, Black Widow spiders can be silent but deadly. You know what else is silent but deadly? A scorpion. So I stripped down to my BVDs, knelt over my pillow, and offered up my nightly prayers. Ever since I turned 12 and had been given the Aaronic priesthood, I'd been secretly praying for the ministering of angels. You know, the Doctrine and Covenants said that I could have one, if I was worthy, and Joseph Smith had had one when he was a kid, so why couldn't I? I said amen and turned on my radio. You know, I liked listening to music as I fell asleep. K-Lite 98.7 FM, an embarrassing collection of soft rock ballads, so I'd be sung to sleep every night by the likes of Roberta Flack, Barry Manilow, or Kool and the Gang. And maybe it was nerdy, but it was also relaxing. But this night, something happened that I'll never forget. Something strange. Something dark. Something that showed me firsthand how very real the adversary can be. I was nearly asleep when a song started playing that just didn't belong on K-Lite. It was Highway to Hell by AC/DC. At first, I just tried to ignore it, but it kept getting louder and louder. So I reached over and I hit the snooze bar, and that would normally shut it off, but this time it didn't. So I hit it again and again, still nothing. So I sat up and I leaned over to reach for the dial, and I turned it to make sure it was off, and it was, but the music still kept on playing. So I leaned over and strained to unplug the whole thing from the wall, and sure enough, the power shut off, but the song kept on playing. It was fainter than it had been, but it was still there. I could still hear it. And that was when I felt this tingle that starts up the back of your spine and just instantly fills your whole body. It was fear. Terrifying, paralyzing fear. Now, I'd heard of this sort of thing before. You know, my dad had been attacked by a paralyzing darkness when he was on his mission, and my seminary teacher told me the story of a demon that he saw one night when he was a kid looking at a Playboy magazine. And, of course, we all know what happened to Joseph Smith as he was starting to pray in the Sacred Grove. The devil is alive and well and actively trying to thwart the progress of God. And he knew that I was destined for missionary greatness. And he hadn't been able to trip me up in any of the typical deviant teenage ways, so he was taking a more direct approach. So I prayed. And I pleaded with the Lord to save me from whatever evil was in the room and to please make the music stop. But it didn't, not until the song finally reached its end. So there I was, in total silence, alone in my bed, surrounded by this thick, palpable darkness. But that was nothing compared to what was about to happen next. It still gives me chills to even think about it. And I really don't even like talking about it. But laying there alone in the darkness, I heard a voice. It was clear and as real as the voice that you're hearing from me right now. And it said my name, Glenn. A chill shot right through me. Was this real? Was someone actually in my room? Was I just making it up? Were these voices in my head? And then I heard it again. Glenn. I sat up and I flipped on the light. Standing at the far end of my room, right in front of my window, was a man. He had light hair and blue eyes, and if I had this skill, I could sketch him to the smallest detail, even to this day. And he was smiling at me. "Don't be afraid," he said. "The Lord has heard your prayers and has sent me to minister unto you." And he smiled again. He extended his arms as if he knew that this was the fulfillment of everything I'd ever wished for. But something about it just didn't feel right. You know, I was still feeling that cold, tingling fear and not the warm, reassuring calm that you'd expect from a ministering angel. And I immediately remembered a scripture from the DNC, these three grand keys that Joseph Smith had given, how to discern a good angel from an evil one. I needed to ask to shake his hand, because if he's from God and if he's a resurrected being, then I'll feel the solid flesh and I'll know. Or if he's from God but he hasn't been resurrected, he'll just politely decline and then deliver his message anyway. But if he's an evil spirit, he'll attempt to deceive me and he'll reach out with his hand, and I'll take it, and I'll feel nothing. The thought terrified me, but okay, that's what I've got to do. That's how I can know for sure. So I tried to keep my voice as calm and steady as possible, and I asked, "Could I shake your hand?" He smiled again like he'd heard this question a million times before. "Of course," he said, and he moved towards me. And I remember, he didn't walk, you know, he didn't move his legs, he just moved. And then he was right there, right in front of me. His arm was extended and he was still smiling, and my heart was just pounding. And I steadied my hand as best as I could, and I reached up and I grabbed onto his hand, and nothing. And this instant jolt of terror just shot through me. And then I knew what I had to do. I slowly began raising my arm to the square. He looked at me as if he'd seen this a million times before, too, and before I could even utter a single syllable, His entire countenance just changed. Like, instead of the bright, pleasant, light-haired man who had first appeared, his face transformed into this angry, twisted, evil snarl. I quickly said what I had to say, using all of my power to keep the words from sticking in my throat. In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave. And immediately, he was hit by what seemed like some kind of vacuum that grabbed a hold of him from behind and started dragging him back towards my window. He fought against it, and he shrieked the most awful shriek I'd ever heard. It was just like they say in the scriptures, a wailing and gnashing of teeth. And he was cursing me the entire time. You think you've defeated me? You'll never be free of me. We're all around you. We'll always be with you. We know exactly how to get you. And then with that, he was gone, and I was left alone, completely freaked out of my mind. And that was by far the most terrifying night of my life. Except that it actually wasn't. Because, well, this never actually happened. I mean, I told people this story, all right. I told a lot of people. And many of them believed it. You know, why wouldn't they? It hit all the expected narrative conventions for a story like this. And more importantly, it supported their Mormon worldview. It validated their beliefs. One friend of mine actually shared it with investigators on his mission as evidence that this work was true. And when he got back and I told him it wasn't true, he's like, what? I told everybody that story. But I just made it up. And the reason why I made it up, now it seems so stupid and trivial, but I had this friend, Kevin Sparks, and he would listen to heavy metal music, and I thought this was just soul-numbing devil music. And I wanted him to stop. So I made up this story because I was trying to scare him straight. And ironically enough, of all the people that I told the story to, Kevin was the one to call bullshit right off the bat. Knock it off, he said. I kept telling it to other people, though, because I liked the effect that it had on them. I could see their response. I could feel it. And it gave me this sort of power over them, at least the ones who really believed it. And that power, it was pretty addicting. Now, I remember the last time that I ever told it. This time really scared me. So I was a freshman at BYU, and I'd gone up into the canyon with a big group of people I didn't really know. And we were gathered around a campfire telling scary stories, and I was just waiting because I knew I had them all beat. So I just waited my turn, and then I started up. It was a normal night, just like any other night. You know, it was totally silent as I told it. Everyone was staring at me with their eyes wide. It was probably my best performance ever. And a little while after I finished, this guy came up to me. And he shook my hand, and there were tears in his eyes. And he said, I just want you to know that you were inspired to share that sacred experience with us tonight. Sacred? Inspired? As in, this huge lie that I made up was something that he thought was a message directed to him through me from God? Oh, crap. So he went on to tell me that he'd recently decided not to go on a mission. And what's worse, he'd come up to the canyon that night with his girlfriend and the back of his truck and just one sleeping bag because they were planning, you know, to do it. But when he heard my story, he realized what a terrible mistake he was about to make. He realized all the many different ways that the devil was trying to destroy him. And he felt the spirit so strong confirmed to him that he needed to change his ways. The guy actually started crying, and he hugged me, and he thanked me. And even though I guess I should have been sort of happy for this seminary video-esque return and sin no more CTR moment, I actually just felt like crap. I learned two very valuable life-altering lessons that night. First, the spirit, and can you hear my air quotes, can confirm the truthfulness of even the biggest smoking pile of horseshit. And second, fear can be a powerful motivator. Fear sucks. I really sort of hate fear. Now, I suppose there's some intrinsic evolutionary value to fear in the sense of self-preservation. You know, in the sense of avoiding life's black widow spiders and other silent but deadly things. But to me, fear's like a cancer weed. It's just far too easy to take root and spread and grow and just completely take over, just blocking us from so many important experiences in life. Have any of you seen the movie Defending Your Life? There's this scene where Al Brooks is sitting across from Rip Torn, and Al Brooks has just died, and he's awaiting some kind of judgment.
So, is this what you thought it would be?
Thought what would be? Where am I? Is this heaven?
No, it isn't heaven.
Is it hell?
No, it isn't hell either. Let me tell you what's going on. When you're born into this universe, you're in it for a long, long time. You have many different lifetimes. And after each lifetime, there's an examining period, which you're in now.
Every second of every lifetime is always recorded. And as each one ends, we sort of look at it. Look at a few of the days, examine it. And then if everybody agrees, you move forward.
What do you mean move forward?
I mean move forward, continue onward. The point of this whole thing is to keep getting smarter, to keep growing, to use as much of your brain as possible. For example, I use 48% of my brain. Do you know how much you use?
47?
3.
I'm sorry?
3.
I use 3% of my brain?
Yes, don't worry about it. Everybody on Earth uses 3% of their brain. 3 to 5%. That's why they're there.
3%? You mean nobody on Earth uses more than that?
When you use more than 5% of your brain, you don't want to be on Earth, believe me. Now, being from Earth as you are and using as little of your brain as you do, your life has pretty much been devoted to dealing with fear.
It has?
Well, everybody on Earth deals with fear. That's what little brains do.
What are little brains?
That's what we call you folks behind your back. Fear is like a giant fog. It sits on your brain and blocks everything. Real feelings, true happiness, real joy. They can't get through that fog. But you lift it, and buddy, you're in for the ride of your life.
God, my 3% is swimming.
I don't think I can express it any better than that. Fear is what keeps little brains little. Fear just sucks. Now, I often heard growing up in the church that faith is the opposite of fear, that our faith in the atonement would overcome any fear that we might have about anything that happens to us in our lives. Well, that sounds pretty good, right? And yet, so many experiences in the church seem to be driven by that very fear that we're supposed to have been freed from. Like, what if I don't magnify my callings? Or what if other people see my faults? Or what if I don't live up to every covenant that I have made in the temple or anywhere else? What if I'm just unworthy? I really hate that word, unworthy. It means not worthy. I mean, think about it. It means you have no worth. It means you're worthless. How would it change things in the church if instead of people saying something like, he's not worthy to go to the temple, if we said, he can't go to the temple because he's worthless? Because isn't that basically saying the same thing? And this fear of being worthless gets drilled into us from such a young age. And once it's there, this fear of being worthless can be exploited and abused. And it happens far too often. That's true whether you're in the church or out of it, whether people are meaning to do it or not, whether the object of these fears is real or just a huge smoking pile of horseshit. You may even use fear tactics to manipulate people that you love because it's easy and it's incredibly effective. Because fear makes people do things that they normally wouldn't do. Fear keeps people stuck in abusive and codependent relationships. Fear keeps people from experiencing life, from taking risks and making mistakes and getting up and trying all over again. Fear makes people shut down governments and hate Obama. Fear prevents progress. Fear is damnation. So at this wonderful time of Halloween, when we celebrate all the hauntingly superficial thrills that tricks and treats and fear can bring, remember how much fear actually sucks. Remember how pervasive and subtle and sneaky and damaging it can be. And take a moment to look around at the people you love. Look at the way you interact with them, at the way you interact even with yourself. And if you're exploiting a sense of worthlessness or using any kind of fear tactics to try to control or manipulate behavior, Knock it off. Or else. And these things I humbly say in the name of Skeleton Jack. Boo.
I still remember telling people that story. And the ones who believed me that shocked me. Like, I even tried to use that story as a missionary opportunity to explain to my non-Mormon friends in high school how true the church was, because I had seen a angel that turned into the devil that wouldn't shake my hand. Mm-hmm. Or no, he did shake my hand, but I didn't feel anything. That was the story.
And you always... Did you always let them in at the end?
No.
So you used it as a to increase your spiritual cred.
No, it started off as a lie, kind of as a way to try and get my friend Kevin to stop listening to his devil music. You know, the AC/DC and Led Zeppelin was like the devil music for me back then. And
you were lying for the Lord.
I was lying for his soul. Yeah,
that's for the Lord.
And but then I started seeing the reaction, and he never bought it at all. He never did. But other people that I told, they're like, "Wow, no, that's crazy." And so then it was that time at BYU when I told it and had the guy come up to me at the end, and he was like, "I felt the Spirit so strong," and I just was flooded with guilt, like, "No way."
Oh, the thing is, Mormons want, you know. I remember missionaries on my mission just gathering around and telling stories about this guy who kept yelling for Cain. Every night he would go outside and yell for Cain to come, and then finally a big hairy black man showed up, beat the shit out of him, and said, "Stop calling my name."
I think you just made that up.
Oh, that's great. That's a good intro to the Meldrum Bigfoot one.
Yeah, that one's on here, isn't it?
Yeah, that's on the list.
Yeah, that had like 2,900 downloads, which surprised me.
Stop calling my name, you son of a bitch.
I love how Meldrum Part 1 isn't on the list, but Meldrum Part 2 is.
Yeah, part 1 had more downloads than Part 2 did. There was a drop-off. I think a lot of the multi-part series have drop-offs, and I don't know why.
Yeah, but Part 2 was the Bigfoot part, which is way more interesting than the
evolution
than
part
1, where we're talking about evolution and age of the Earth and that sort of thing. I mean, it's kind of... It's a little more dry. I mean, it was the Part 2 was the fun part.
How much time was between? Do you remember? It wasn't a ton of time.
Releasing Part 1 and Part 2?
Yeah.
No, it was almost nothing.
Yeah.
It was maybe a month, but it wasn't a lot.
Cool.
So, I have a confession to make. I've listened to all of our episodes except for the Meldrum ones. I don't know why. It's just, it's nothing against you, Scott. I just want to throw it out there. For some reason, it's just like the same way I haven't seen the movie Titanic.
You just had to get that off your chest.
The same reason why you haven't seen Titanic, because I don't remember
the way. I'm just saying, like, at this point, I almost don't want to listen just to keep it up, but I think I will. If it's part of a Throwback Friday, then it's like not...
It's not the same one.
Old episode. Yeah.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Anyway.
So yeah, try to sleep at night now, Scott.
Was there anything, Scott, with that interview with Meldrum that, like, surprised you or kind of stuck out to you?
Well, I mean, I had done research before it, and I knew that he was very interested in Bigfoot, but then when I asked him how certain or what the odds were that that Bigfoot was actually real.
Can you understand me? Are you a man? Oh, it never hurts to ask. Easy now, easy. I don't want to hurt you. I'd like to think the feeling's mutual. Okay, have it your way.
I would be remiss if I was on the line with you here and I didn't talk to you about the Sasquatch aspect. So is it okay if we change gears to that?
As long as you don't ask me if it was Cain.
That was the first thing I was going to ask you.
Well, we can touch on that because I get asked that over and over and over again.
I'm sure. Yeah. Okay, so So we're on it already. Yeah. So what's your thought on that? I mean, well, this is the I'll give a little background for the listeners. So there's a story. I think it was originally related by David Patton, and it was later written about by Abraham Smoot. If I'm getting that right, and it was actually quoted in The Miracle of Forgiveness in the section on murderers, where President Kimball referenced Kane as being a murderer and then included this rather bizarre story about David Patton riding his mule.
Allow me to read for you this portion from Spencer W. Kimball's book, The Miracle of Forgiveness. The Murderer. John wrote that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. The murderer denies himself salvation in the celestial kingdom, and in this sense he cannot be forgiven for his crime. The instance of the first murder is instructive. Though thoroughly taught the gospel by his parents, Cain loved Satan more than God. He became rebellious, carnal, sensual, and devilish. Cain was to become the father of Satan's lies and to be called perdition. His culminating sin was the murder of his brother Abel, which he did by secret covenant with Satan and to gain Abel's possessions. As a punishment, the Lord consigned the wicked Cain to be a fugitive and a vagabond, and placed a mark upon him which would reveal his identity. On the sad character of Cain, an interesting story comes to us from Lycurgus A. Wilson's book on the life of David W. Patton. From the book, I quote an extract from a letter by Abraham O. Smoot, giving his recollection of David Patton's account of meeting, quote, a very remarkable person who had represented himself as being Cain, unquote. As I was riding along the road on my mule, I suddenly noticed a very strange personage walking beside me. His head was about even with my shoulders as I sat in my saddle. He wore no clothing, but was covered with hair. His skin was very dark. I asked him where he dwelt, and he replied that he had no home, that he was a wanderer in the earth and traveled to and fro. He said that he was a very miserable creature, that he had earnestly sought death during his sojourn upon the earth, but he could not die, and his mission was to destroy the souls of men. About the time he expressed himself thus, I rebuked him in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and by virtue of the holy priesthood, and commanded him to go hence, and he immediately departed out of my sight.
Kimball didn't actually say the word Bigfoot or Sasquatch in there, but a lot of people, I think it's fair to say, a lot of LDS people have taken that to be, that's the explanation for Bigfoot. Yeah. So you're the Sasquatch expert. what are your thoughts on that as a Mormon, as a professor, as a foremost scholar on this? You get asked this all the time. I've got to hear your answer. Sure.
Well, you know,
and then maybe people will stop asking you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe. Well, you know, if Spencer W. Kimball hadn't cited that story and related it without commentary whatsoever, no one would be asking me this question. But because that Miracle of Forgiveness is such a widely read book, you know, it's one of those seminal works that just about everybody has read at some point. It's widely known. The story became widely known. But, you know, and it's open to interpretation. It's been a long time since I've read it, but my impression was he didn't describe this as a hair-covered giant, but as a tall, hairy man. So does that mean he had long head hair and a long, flowing beard or what? But he did very explicitly say that that this individual identified himself as Cain, and he was cursed to wander the face of the earth seeking the destruction of the souls of mankind. And he then raised his arm to the square and rebuked him and sent him on his way and arrived home in a fairly shaken state, apparently, rather disturbed by his experience. But, you know, what that means, whether it was in vision, whether it was physical, whether it was a great hairy hulk or a long-haired hillbilly appearing individual, I have no way to determine. But
so in your Sasquatch hunts, then, there hasn't been any large, hairy individuals who've walked alongside you and told you that they're Cain yet?
Not yet. Okay. Now, someone did write a very fascinating novel, and I apologize. Yeah. His name escapes me, but playing on that story is the introduction to the novel, and then he goes into the hunt by this intrepid cryptozoologist, and Of course, we all know there was a curse leveled on Cain's head, that anyone who killed him would reap the curse 7 times 70. And so in the final scene, this is a spoiler alert. In the final scene, you have the hunter chasing or pursuing the Bigfoot into the cave and it disappears from sight. And then the report of a rifle is heard. And a few moments later, a different Bigfoot walks out of the cave. And so this is how the Bigfoot legend has been perpetuated, is each time the individual's been killed, the curse has fallen on the murderer, and that person perpetuates the legend.
So it's like a werewolf or vampire myth.
That's right.
Almost.
That's right.
Okay.
So a very clever turn of a tale, I guess. But as a biologist, as an anthropologist, I see this question as merely the question of the existence of a biological species of primate. It may be a cousin of a great ape, like a gorilla or chimpanzee, that has simply, as we talked about earlier, converged on our mode of locomotion, and so it's adopted because of environmental constraints or selection pressures, a bipedal posture, which is not extraordinary given the constraints of the shoulder girdle and arrangement of the chest of great apes. Walking on your hands on all fours is not a straightforward process, because we've evolved in a different direction for arm hanging and swinging, suspending our weight beneath a tree on a very flexible wrist and a cranially directed shoulder.
I want to talk about a number of things, but okay. For you, what's the interest in? I mean, obviously, you're a biologist. You're interested in morphology and in primates specifically. But is there, you know, growing up, did you have an interest in Bigfoot? Is there something kind of early on that drove that for you, or is it just you're in Idaho and it's something that you kind of fell into, or how did that come about?
Well, kind of all of the above. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and so I was aware of some of the stories about Sasquatch from British Columbia and Bigfoot and so on. And I was living in Spokane, Washington as a youngster, about age 11, when in 1968, Roger Patterson, who captured about 60 seconds of this fleeting glimpse of a Sasquatch walking across the sandbar and disappearing into the forest. He had showcased that in a documentary that he was traveling around the United States exhibiting. And I saw that. And, you know, to a young mind who's already interested in all things prehistoric, the notion of dinosaurs and fossil men and so forth, the prospect of a, quote, missing link or an ape man was fascinating to me, to say the least, let alone the whole mystique and the mystery of an unknown in our own backyard here in the woods of the Western United States and Canada. It may have influenced my interests. I was always interested in anatomy, both human and comparative anatomy. Even as a youngster, I was fascinated with zoology, and I pursued a career in anatomical sciences with an emphasis in physical anthropology. And I was particularly interested in how animals move. I mean, when you think about what shapes animals, there are basically three behaviors that have impact on their appearance: the way they eat, and so that largely is apparent in their jaws and masticatory apparatus, the dentition, and the skull, how the skull supports all that. Or the way they move, either to catch food or to escape becoming food. And so the postcranial skeleton, the body, that really takes on the shape. You know, a cheetah looks the way a cheetah does because it's able to, and it relies on its tremendous speed to run down a gazelle. And a gazelle is fleet-footed in order to attempt to escape the cheetah. And so my focus was primarily on how animals move. And I was, of course, interested in human bipedalism. And so my academic career took me down a path that involved the study of both non-human primates and how they moved, the study of skeletal remains, fossil remains, and analogies between those fossils and living taxa in order to infer and reconstruct locomotive behaviors of the long extinct species, but and more particularly the advent of human bipedalism and our evolutionary history, what has shaped our body and our ability to run. And, you know, humans are unique amongst the primates in that we can run marathons. We can train and we have the physiology for endurance, distance running and walking. And that's really set us apart. So the prospect of another biped that would serve as a natural experiment in comparison and contrast to our condition was one that was always rattling around in the back of my head as a very interesting possibility. And then the falling into it kind of occurred. You know, it was very dangerous, risky to profess an interest in something that had such a tabloid stigma as the existence of Bigfoot by an academic. But eventually I was naive enough to launch into it when some circumstances literally dropped it in my lap. And in 1996, I came face to face with a long line of very fresh footprints in southeastern Washington. These were humanoid in shape, 15 inches long, very spontaneous, very animated. And the hair, you know, stood up on the back of my neck when that realization began to settle in that, my gosh, you know, a Sasquatch just walked by here a few hours. Or else someone who was a very sophisticated hoaxer is pulling the wool over my eyes. And it seemed that at that stage of my career, I should be able to evaluate the likelihood of one scenario versus the other. So we pulled some casts from that. I started collecting casts from other individuals and replicating them. I have over 200 footprint casts in my laboratory now. We've archived over 180 of those by way of three-dimensional scanning. Those will soon be available to the public and to other investigators once we get our web portal reconstructed. And I've published extensively. I've presented extensively at professional meetings. And not only proposed a model to explain the distinctions of the Sasquatch foot, but I've even attached an ichnotaxonomic name to them. Ichnotaxonomy is a parallel system of taxonomy that is applied to tracks and traces, usually of unknown extinct species for whom tracks have been found or traces, burrows, so forth, footprints, trails, but for whom the body of the track maker or its remains have never been found. So you have a handle. And after floating the notion of attaching a gnomon to these Sasquatch tracks with several professional ichnotaxonomists and presenting such a proposal at a symposium on Cenozoic tracks and traces, I got sort of the implicit nod, overt in some instances, to go ahead and submit the abstracts or submit the manuscript. And so there is a name attached, Anthropoidopes ameriborealis, Meldrum 2007, which simply means North American 8-foot. And there's a distinctive diagnosis. This is a consistent suite of characteristics that seems to typify the credible footprint examples that we have accumulated. And, you know, as one of my colleagues, a very renowned naturalist, George Schaller, said when he shown some of this data, he said, well, obviously, there's something out there. Now, let's talk about how you're going to identify it. I mean, that's what struck me. I mean, I was really gratified to him, to another professional who's familiar with primate anatomy, who's spent his entire life in the study of natural history of species across the globe. It was obvious. It's obvious that you have something, or there is something out there based on this footprint evidence.
So for you, is that the strongest evidence then supporting that kind of primate? It's not the Gimlin film, or it's not, you know, these kind of blurry images that we've seen on the internet or that sort of thing. I mean, the footprints are what does it for you?
They do. Because from my position of expertise, they convey the most significance to me. And
so you see a footprint and you're not seeing... You're not seeing a smear in the mud. You're right. Seeing a joint, and you're seeing a knee, and you're seeing how a hip would flex on it, and that sort of thing. You're trained to be able to read those signs
right
from a track and know what kind of an anatomy would produce those.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. To the extent that that's possible, and it's never you know, in every circumstance, the conditions are varied, varying quality of substrate conditions and preservation, age of the track, and so forth. So, you know, it's not black and white in every instance. But when you have a large sample like I have, the consistency quickly emerges, and the underlying anatomy becomes very apparent as it relates to that consistency and to the distinctions that are seen between our footprint and their footprint and fossil hominid footprints. You know, so you know, my quote orthodox studies have encompassed the analysis of hominid footprints around the world. We've got a review paper that will be coming out shortly that does review the entire hominid footprint record, and many of them have unfortunately not been given their due consideration. But it's remarkable what you can infer from this evidence. Yeah, absolutely.
So, a couple of questions then. What likelihood do you put on the existence of this kind of this primate? I mean, what if there's a number, a percentage that you could put on it, based on everything you've seen?
Right.
How likely is it? Is there a chance that it doesn't exist and these are all hoaxes and it's just, hey, there happens to be a lot of similar footprints, or for some reason there's a biased sample of these footprints? You know, the better ones are making it up the chain to you, and the really bad ones, you know, never make it out of the garage sale. What are the odds there?
Yeah, and those exist. I mean, and I have examples in my collection that are obviously fake. There's no question in my mind that they're fake. But you know, to be honest, I have to qualify my own opinion, because we don't have that definitive type specimen, or even yet a definitive novel DNA sequence to mm-hmm. indicate. So short of that, you know, if you want to say 99% certain.
So personally, you're quite certain.
Yes.
That it exists.
Quite certain that it exists. Yeah. I mean, no. When you sit across the table or across the living room from an eyewitness who you have come to know well, or who you already have known really well, who has had a face-to-face daylight experience, sustained experience or encounter, you know, how do you say to that person, well, you were mistaken? You know, I mean, setting all the other evidence aside for just a moment and just considering the anecdotal eyewitness testimonies, I mean, yes, you're always at the mercy of their credibility. You're at the mercy of their powers of observation and ability to interpret what they're experiencing, and you know, their suggestibility. You know, people sometimes see what they want to see, and so a flash of bear fur might take on the aura of a Sasquatch lurking in the shadows, and that person may be absolutely convinced that they had a Sasquatch encounter. They can't rationalize it any other way. But there are also instances like, you know, a woman in Denver or in Colorado, south of Denver, who had one standing outside on the opposite side of her tent, 10 feet from her at 3:30 in the afternoon, 8 feet tall, covered with hair. She sat and locked eyes with it. It was kind of investigating her camp. It was very curious about her pack goats. And then it turned and walked away, you know, but this person is reliable, sensible person, and she describes it in extreme detail, and it changed her life. I mean, her life was never the same after that remarkable experience. So, you know, those happen again and again and again and again. You know, not like I said, someone seeing a flash of fur, hearing a bump in the night, or attributing, you know, every overturned rock or broken branch to Sasquatch activity. But the case is growing, you know, and sometimes I'm sort of singled out as that lone voice in the wilderness, kind of, crying after this theme or this hypothesis. I work with lots of people behind the scenes, and I've networked with lots of agency personnel who have had experiences themselves or who've been the recipient of reports of people in the national parks or national forests, you know. Foresters and game wardens and wildlife biologists and those of my colleagues, trackers and anthropologists and state veterinarians, state archaeologists. I mean, there are lots of professional people who are very, very interested in this subject. You know, when I'm
so yeah. So what? Why is it then that? I mean, what's something's got to be very different then from this species compared to any other large animal that we've seen on Earth? I mean, I would think so, because that you're saying there's no, we don't have any DNA evidence, so there hasn't been any fur.
Oh yes, there is. There is. There has been hair, but this, you know, the skeptics will just kind of throw their hands up at this, but the qualities of that particular type of hair, which the most significant aspect is the acellular medulla, the central core, which in many species has stacked cells, is devoid of those stacked cells. It has an acellular or a cell-less medulla. And that's not unique to Sasquatch by any means. And even some humans exhibit that. Individuals with very pale hair, with very, you know, strawberry blonde or pale hair might exhibit that condition, as well as other animals. Polar bears have an acellular medulla. They have a very hollow hair shaft, and that's why they turn green sometimes. Algae actually get down in that central shaft and grow.
Okay, but be that as it may, I mean, there's been no, I mean, there's not, other than the Gimlin film or maybe like a handful of, you know, fairly in, there hasn't been any kind of HD footage of this yet. There's no, I mean, people put these cameras out in the forest all the time, hoping to, you know, it's pictures of every other animal that's out there. Just about, it seems like, you know, there's elk and deer and, you know, rabbits and bears that'll set these camera traps off. And I understand you have a blimp project, or there's some project with a blimp in the works. So maybe will help, but I'm just wondering what your working theory is as to why we haven't had better photographic documentation of the Sasquatch. Right.
Well, in some ways, they are different than at least the common wildlife that are out there. And even, you know, there are, you know, I could point to a number of species who have never had their picture taken by a game cam until just a couple of weeks ago or a month ago. You know, there have been some startling discoveries, particularly down in Southeast Asia, for example, and some species that are very rare have turned up on game cameras. So there's always something to happen, something unexpected that could happen. But those singular kind of examples, those rather unique sort of examples, are involving animals that have some of the same characteristics that apparently are attributable to Sasquatch. They're extremely rare, I believe. I mean, given the number of footprints and the diversity of footprints in a given geographical area. I mean, we frequently have repeat appearances of recognizable individuals rather than many different individuals in a given geographical area when footprints are found. So they're very rare. They are solitary, it seems. Most sightings and most footprint finds are of single individuals or what we presume to be a female with offspring. They're very far-ranging. Indirect and direct evidence in terms of the distribution of footprints and the pattern of distribution of sightings suggest a home range of on the order of maybe 1,000 square miles. So they move through the environment in order to forage for more widely dispersed food items than what you would find in a dense tropical forest. So when you have all and they're often active at night. They're nocturnal, largely, it seems. Not strictly, I wouldn't think, but largely nocturnal. So when you combine all those things, the rarity, the nocturnality, the solitarity, the wide-ranging behaviors and generality in their behavior and diet, it's, in my mind, it's not that surprising. It's frustrating, it's vexing, but it's not that surprising. There's a growing literature on the use of game cameras showing that top predators are frequently avoiding the game cameras. Now, and whether it's electronic emissions or light leakage or scent, or just simply, as has been suggested, the novelty of this item, even well camouflaged, on a well-used game trail. I mean, these animals, they know every square inch of these trails they traverse, and you stick something up there and you disturb it, and they're paranoid about it. And they've documented, for example, coyotes circumventing game cameras. And they're just not always reliable either. One of my friends who's active down in the Texas area, in Oklahoma area, you know, he said, we had a game camera, an expensive game camera, deployed. And he said, we happened to be watching at this particular instance, and a bear ambled up into the supposed area of sensitivity. And that bear was there for 20 minutes before it left, and not a single picture registered on the camera. So, you know, I hate to give apologetic answers, but the skepticism has to be tempered by a realistic understanding of the variables at play. And when you consider the variables, I mean, they're exactly what you would expect for an animal to have remained as elusive as it has remained. I mean, that's...
Sure. If we haven't found it yet, there's a pretty good reason why, or there's a lot of good reasons probably why we wouldn't have found it.
Right.
So tell us about this airship,
right,
with the project with that. What's going on with that?
Well, it's entitled the Falcon Project, and it's the brainchild of a colleague that named William Barnes, who dreamed this up after he had an encounter in California. He was a gold dredger, and he had an individual right about dusk come down into his camp and sort of inspect things and walk right through camp. He was hidden away inside his tent, but could see out through an opening, and got a very clear view of this creature. From then on, he, you know, and again, as with so many people, it changed his life, the impact, and sometimes the drive to try to prove the existence in order to vindicate their experience, and to challenge the ridicule that sometimes is heaped on individuals who acknowledge such an experience. But the point is, He conferred and consulted with various engineers and photographers and so forth, and came up with this notion of using an aerial approach. Aerial wildlife surveys have been carried out repeatedly. It's common. You can Google aerial wildlife surveys and find companies that provide, commercially provide this service to agency personnel. But they're usually employing fixed-winged aircraft or helicopters. And there are disadvantages to that. The challenge that we have is trying to find an animal that occupies the dense forests of the Northwest. And so having an airship that can hover some 2,000 to 3,000 feet over the forest canopy and peer vertically right down through between the trees with high-end sophisticated thermal imaging equipment and high-definition videography equipment, we're hoping that we'll be able to pick up, well, we're confident we'll be able to pick up heat signatures on the forest floor. And then once we've done some experimentation and identified profiles of common wildlife, deer, elk, moose, bear, and even humans, maybe even humans in costumes, just to rule them out, then we'll be able to distinguish something that's anomalous, something that's different, something that may be standing upright. And we'll coordinate with ground insertion teams that will attempt to converge on any target and identify trace and physical evidence, maybe even have a visual encounter with it as well. But the idea is we want to first, identify and get those definitive pictures, but that's when the work really begins. That's
sure.
When we start tracking, we start gaining knowledge about their movement patterns, their activity patterns, whether they are nocturnal or diurnal in the majority of their behaviors, and maybe get to the point where we can locate consistently and maybe even get a tracking device attached or injected. We had one gentleman who called us up who specializes in these little dragonfly drones, mm-hmm. and he said, you could put a platform on your airship that these can land and take off from. You can guide them visually because they can be loaded up with a small camera just for navigation, and then have a hypodermic syringe loaded on the front with a little injectable transmitter. And this thing zips down there like a mosquito and stings the Sasquatch in the derriere and implants this subdermal transmitter that'll last for a a couple weeks, maybe, you know, because you're not going to have the size to carry a big battery and all that.
Wow, that is incredible.
That'd be something.
I mean, yeah, it would be something. You had better prepare to do a lot more TV interviews if you're if this Project Falcon is successful. I mean, that would just blow the doors off of primate research. I mean,
coincidentally, no sooner had we made our announcement of this initiative, ambitious as it is, then I was notified by a colleague who had just attended a conference on great ape conservation, and there was an entire symposium devoted to the use of unmanned drones in aerial surveys of great ape populations. And the example that he shared with me was the individual who was using it to identify tree nests of orangutans in Borneo or Sumatra, and I can't remember which. This fellow is now serving on our scientific advisory board for the Falcon Project on the condition that once we find Sasquatch, we'll let him use the equipment to go to Africa and do some surveys for African apes.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah. Well, so what's the time frame for this project, or is the funding in place?
Plan, and again, the William Barnes came to me with his plan and asked, it turns out that the FAA regulations for a research and education project sponsored through an institution of higher learning has much more lenient regulations than a commercial venture would. And plus having the advantage of the auspices of an institution like Idaho State University, he asked that I broach this with our Office of Scientific Research, and I did. It's a little unprecedented because they're used to handling proposals for a fixed amount of money that are going to a specific agency, whereas we're appealing to the public and to private donors and commercial donors, commercial sponsors for this, because as legitimate and as scientifically sound as this approach is, the fact that we're looking for Sasquatch means we have a snowball's chance of any federal funding, especially under the conditions of sequestration now.
Sure.
So that was the intent. So we're doing fundraising. We're courting sponsors. We have a couple that are in the wings and a couple that are about one that's ready to launch a very ambitious PR campaign to get the word out. And then we've set up an account through the ISU Foundation to receive tax-deductible private donations.
So if any of our listeners are interested in this and they want to kick a few dollars your way, they can go to that website. We'll put a link up with this post.
Okay.
To it, and they can go there and hopefully contribute to your project.
Okay, good.
I could see it floating over the forests of Idaho.
Yeah,
you know, the Pepsi insertion team, Sasquatch right. Six.
We had some interest at least initially. We haven't followed up yet. We need to do this, but Red Bull, which sponsored that jump from outer space,
right. Yeah.
They were intrigued by some of the analogy there. And so that's a possibility. You might see Red Bull logo.
Sure.
Is there any?
Yeah. They've got wings, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say too, to your listeners as well, one of the things that we're very interested in doing is, because I'm always very, a real advocate of the citizen scientist, that because of the nature of this animal and the difficulty of an academic just going out into the field and collecting data. And I've spent months at a time doing that with variable success, but it really relies on the eyes and ears of all those other people who are out there, much like national bird counts, and so the more people understand about discriminating data and collecting evidence in the field so that it will be useful scientifically, the better off. But in regards to the Falcon Project, if this gets off the ground, we'll be collecting terabytes of data, video data, and so what we plan to do is to parse this into packets that can be downloaded by the citizen scientist who subscribes to a web page, and they can review that that video imagery and thermal imagery, and with a time code and indicate those anomalous features that may be of interest, post them on the webpage, draw our attention to them, and to the attention of all the other people who are looking at their video files, and that can be discussed in a blog format and the possibilities evaluated.
Yeah, so you're looking to crowdsource
the
time-consuming part of it.
Involve them. I mean, so that, you know, you can look for Sasquatch.
Right.
As well.
Well, I don't know if you'll be able to find anybody interested in that on the internet.
You don't think so?
You'd know better than I would.
Well, that was fine. That was fun. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Yeah, I hope, like I said, I hope I don't get a call from my stake president, Bishop here.
No, you'll be fine.
Be kind with the editing. Yeah.
Yeah, we're obscure enough. He'll never see it. So,
well, you'd be surprised. We did a thing. One of the other controversial issues that I've gotten roped into was the DNA in the Book of Mormon,
right?
And written in the book, and we got roped into a Sunstone Symposium and got kind of broadsided by the organizer. But I suddenly got both Trent Stevens and I got calls from our stake president, and he'd been instructed to have a personal priesthood interview with us. Regarding this, and they sent him a tape, and he said, "Well, I listened to the tape. I can tell their voices. They're defending the Book of Mormon." And he goes, "Well, we want you to interview them anyway." And so
this was someone higher up than the stake president.
Oh yes. He got his marching orders from the area president. So there was someone in attendance at that panel, and took notes and passed it on to the respective ecclesiastical authorities, and it was on the radar. So. You never know.
Okay. for the person at the church office building who's monitoring this, then do us a favor and just go easy on it.
Sure, there you go.
Okay.
You better make this a short goodbye, George. You've got to go back where you belong now. Hurry, please. Please, there's no time.
Get out of here! Can't you see we don't want you anymore?
Take care of yourself now, okay?
Okay.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Now, Jocko, what for you?
I don't know. There's always Loch Ness.
And he said, you know, pretty close to 100% that he was
really
convinced of it. That was what surprised me in recording it, is he was, you know, at least, you know, 95% convinced. And this is a professional scientist who, you know, gets really frustrated at the church's teachings on science and things like that, that's where he was coming from. That really surprised me.
Yeah.
He hasn't found him yet. I mean, was released in March of 2014.
He found Bigfoot.
Any updates?
He just hasn't told anybody.
Yeah.
Ass kicking.
Yeah.
One of the things that we talked about
was like the beef jerky.
Stop calling my name.
Well, do you remember we did for a couple of those episodes, we did like fake ads, you know, we'd be like, and this week brought to you by skin whitening, by Light and Delight, or whatever. It would be like some fake ad.
This podcast is brought to you by Kimball Skin Whitener. Right. Do you tan a little too easy? Do you have just a little bit too much pigmentation? Try Kimball's Skin Whitener. That is all.
Whiten it lightsome.
Nice.
And I really wanted to do Jack Link's beef jerky.
Sasquatch.
Sasquatch ad for it. But
Sasquatch.
I actually didn't want to like piss him off too much because... Yeah.
You didn't want to mock him.
I didn't want to mock him, and he came into doing this episode like before we really had that much of an audience, and he also didn't really know where I was coming from, but he was super cool with doing it, you know, with this nobody. So I didn't want to mock him too much.
You didn't know that you were going to be like one of the lone voices in a little over a year standing up and opposing in general conference. He had no idea.
He didn't know that, but he was like genuinely worried with some of the stuff he was saying. He's like, well, my stake president might listen, so
I remember
edit that part out or something. Yeah. And then he
totally didn't buy Spencer Kimball's story in Miracle of Forgiveness, where that guy was riding on his horse and Kane.
No, because it messes up his theory. He doesn't think that Kane is Bigfoot.
Right. So
if Kane, he thinks Bigfoot's like an actual, you know,
primate,
hominid species that is. Northwest of the United States. And
as a biologist, that is so unbelievably disappointing that he thinks there's a hominid.
It's like living in Bigfoot.
The most social creature. Hominids are such social creatures. They're
But these have a really big range, Randy. So
and they're huge.
Yeah. They live mostly in trees. So when I talk with them,
trees. Chewbacca lives in a tree.
Yeah, don't make me come down there.
But they were doing this thing called Project Falcon, which, as far as I understand, hasn't really been funded yet. But they were going to make a big, what they called a dirigible, a blimp,
right,
to hover over the skies. And then they were going to crowdsource the video from it, like they were going to do thermal video into the trees, because they said the problem with why there's not been any videos because they live in the trees and they're nocturnal and they're very elusive and
they're shy.
They're shy. But a helicopter would be too noisy and would produce too much downdraft.
And a satellite is just too far.
Yes,
away.
Yeah, a satellite's too far away, and then. And then the a fixed wing aircraft would be too fast, wouldn't be able to look down in the streets. So they
I saw a documentary about this recently. It's called Star Wars.
Yeah,
there's a guy.
Why don't they use drones?
Well, that's what this would be. This would be basically a big drone to look down into it, but it would be able to just kind of float up there. So every night,
Randy,
it would be floating.
The world has no need for a drone. Am I the only one to get that? That's a lyric in one of the hymns. The world has no need for a drone.
All right, this is totally beside the point, but I just want to point out, I deserve some extra Mormon cred points here for coming up with this lyric, because it comes from the hymn, Have I Done Any Good in the World Today, which I grew up singing a line and a lyric that now has been changed. It was changed in 1985. Here's what it used to say. There are chances for work all around just now, opportunities right in our way. Do not let them pass by, saying sometime I'll try, but go and do something today. 'Tis noble of man to work and to give, love's labor has merit alone. Only he who does something is worthy to live. The world has no use for the drone. And now here's what it says in a much cooler, hip way.
There are chances for work all around us now. Opportunities right in our
Sorry, but I told you this episode was going to be spooky.
Spooky. We laugh like soft, mad children, smug in the woolly cotton brains of infancy. The music and voices are all around us.
Hi, guys. This is Destiny, and I'm recording this in my party line voice because, as a woman, I'm sure this will get me on the podcast. Even if John Hamer says no! You can comment on this episode and others on the website infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Oh, did I ever? Anyone for the closing prayer?
Choose, they croon, the ancient ones. The time has come again. Choose now, they croon, beneath the moon, beside an ancient lake. Enter again the sweet forest. Enter the hot dream. Come with us. Everything is broken up in dances.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.